wonderful film restorationist Ross Lippman is going to be talking about his work on Buster Keaton and Samuel Beckett's film and his documentary called Not Film. And he'll be joined by Dennis Doros from Milestone Film and Video, who's going to be showing a preview of their restoration of the Lois Weber silent film called The Dumb Girl of Portici. Later that day, there's a panel on alternative career paths in cinema studies, and among the guests included there is an alumni of our department who just became the third on-camera host ever at Turner Classic Movies, Stephanie Vasquez. And Wednesday, 6 p.m., Linda Williams, if you know her work, one of the great senior scholars in melodrama, pornography, she's a scholar in residence, and she's going to be giving a talk at the invitation of Tisch School of the Arts called Trigger Warnings and Safe Spaces, a very timely thing. And then next, the final weekend in October, this room is home to the biannual Real China Documentary Film Festival with dozens of scholars, critics, and filmmakers coming from China to be part of that. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the brains of the outfit, filmmaker, professor, activist, etc., Lynn Sachs, who's going to introduce Ernie.
Okay, I have a few things to say, just 1 minute. Okay, first of all, I wanted to say it's not a coincidence that I'm wearing a t-shirt for Black Mountain College right now. I rarely wear college t-shirts, but colleges that closed in 1957 kind of deserve it. As you can see, from 1933 to 1957, in a lush pastoral area near Asheville, North Carolina, hundreds of artists and intellectuals came together to think, collaborate, study, try new things, play, and ultimately make some of the best art ever to come out of one place on the globe. I met Ernie Geer in the late 1980s when he was a teacher and I was a graduate student at the San Francisco Art Institute. From Ernie, I learned that making films was a profound metaphysical endeavor, one that pushed you to treat light like a brush and also to understand its properties like a physicist or an optometrist. For Ernie, seeing was, in and of itself, a creative act of pure informed anticipation, as you just saw, and in other films like Serene Velocity, Sidewalk Shuttle, Eureka, and Shift, what you see need never be what you get. While some of the people call the work Ernie does with light, motion, and space magic, I must disagree. In film, as we all know, the magic of cinema requires that we as spectators maintain a suspension of disbelief. With Ernie's work, I am always in the moment, facing the screen, transfixed, completely aware of what I'm seeing, but for the most part, unsure of how this world I know so well has been so brilliantly fragmented, transformed, and ultimately revealed a new way. Like the great teachers of Black Mountain College, Annie and Joseph Albers, Ernie jolts our awareness of color and rhythm, but he never offers us a rose-colored glasses. In addition to being a great filmmaker, Ernie Geer is an astute cinephile with a keen awareness of the history of the medium. His fascination with the developments of early cinema, as well as the culture from which it grows, still photography, magic lanterns, shadow puppets, melodrama, penny arcades, comes through every frame of his work. Like historian Tom Gunning, he, quote, tries to relate the forces of cinema to any other force than storytelling. I feel very lucky to have known Ernie Geer for 30 years and to have him here for our 7th annual experimental lecture.
Maybe I'll stand for a while.
Yeah.
First of all, thank you, Lynn. Try not to be embarrassed by your comments. Thank you. I like that black t-shirt. It's very nice. It's actually not quite, is it black or blue-gray?
Dark blue-gray.
Thank you. And I also want to thank both of you, Dan and Lynn, for inviting me in the first place. Greatly appreciate this occasion. Thank you. And to all of you, welcome. And thank you for putting up with the films in the other room and coming here now for this talk. I'm not so sure about a lecture. I'll just say a random comments on some work and some thoughts about unfinished, incomplete, or whatever. So, to start with, a few months ago, Lynn asked me if I'd be interested in presenting and talking about some of my work here at NYU. Preferably with an emphasis on pieces that were either unfinished, abandoned, or somehow just didn't work out to my satisfaction. It has been an unusual request, first one time I was asked to do that, but I really liked the idea, so that's why I did not fight her or say, no, I won't do that, okay? Before we start with the screening with the first piece this evening, I would like to briefly touch upon the term unfinished, incomplete. A memorable work that comes to mind in that respect for me is Carl Dreyer's Vampire. The work is involved with, I assume you're all familiar with cinema, right? The work is involved with mystery and the unknown. The work is also full of contradictions relative to the literary myths regarding vampires. Vampires, or the undead, are not supposed to be able to reflect their images on mirrors or other reflective surfaces. Yet there is something that occurs in Vampire that contradicts all that. For example, near the beginning of the film, we have a distant image of children, perhaps dead children, reflected on the surface of the river. And it's not the only image of the undead that is reflected on surfaces, including all those shadows. Yeah. How can they project shadows if they're dead? Through the film's cinematography, Dreyer seemed to be very much after a tonal quality of elusiveness and of grayness, and throughout the film, there are illogical actions and jump cuts that are sometimes a bit jarring. As the original was lost, and there are no complete prints of the film, we don't know whether that is what is missing or lost might clarify the mysteries of the narrative. As a result, its incompleteness adds a layer of elusiveness and mystery to the film for me. Another example of unfinishedness. In the summer of 1939, Orson Welles was going to stage a play in Poughkeepsie, New York, a three-act play titled Too Much Johnson. During the two intermissions, Welles planned to screen a couple of episodes of Too Much Johnson, staged and filmed in New York City as well as upstate New York. However, due to economics, he never finished filming. Later on, he did some preliminary editing, but then abandoned the film project and staged the play without any film interludes. The footage was forgotten and assumed lost until fairly recently when it was found in an Italian warehouse. The footage was subsequently preserved in the order in which it was found in the film cans. The result is this marvelous piece containing the full shots as well as all the retakes, outtakes, and footage that quite likely would never have been part of the final edit. The preservation print offers a wonderful documentation of the west side of Lower Manhattan, a hint into the staging of the scenes, as well as a sense of the driving energy of a young Orson Welles, who later on would be tamed by the codes and production values of the film industry. So this preservation offers another rich perspective on the possibilities of an unfinished or never realized work, one in which the original narrative is embedded within a larger framework. I'm told you can see the work on YouTube in case you are not familiar with it. One of my earliest recollections of experiences that might have had an influence on my own filmmaking dates back to either preschool or first grade, with a teacher handing out an outline of a drawing on a sheet of paper along with some crayons. We were supposed to paint in or fill in the so-called correct colors for each object depicted on the paper. But I found it more fun to just apply colors onto the sheet of paper and not worry about realistic representation of objects. A horse with a yellow head, a green belly, and a blue tail seemed more fun to me than filling in the outlines of a horse with a dull brown lifelike color. And why should a patch of color be confined to the outlines within a shape? This, as well as some other experiences over the years, were very helpful later on in facilitating my appreciation of modernist painting with their various approaches to a breakup of the picture window. My childhood recollections, as well as my later appreciation of 20th century painting, taught me that no matter how focused a work was on subject matter or cinematic possibilities, that on some level, the work should still have a quality of open-endedness. Here is a work, remember Morning, the first film we saw after the break this evening? Okay, I'd like to just briefly touch upon that. Morning is the first film I made in 60mm, recorded in 1967, and then completed, you might say, 1968. The film Morning offers a poetic rendition of mourning, but that representation is entwined with the acknowledgement that it is coming by way of the physical material of film. And by the way, that print you saw was, realize it's moving toward red. It's not a good print, unfortunately. Okay, it's one of the things that happens when you work with industrial and chemical material. You know, in time, things tend to change. Okay. The film starts with light flares that are part of the beginning of a roll of film, when it is not loaded into a camera in a pitch dark space. Normally, such flares are not included in a film. They are edited out. But in Morning, that is the beginning of the film, even before any image of Morning appears on screen. Subsequently, photographic images of Morning are introduced, and then a rendition of Morning begins to take place, but always with the emphatic emphasis of their dependency upon light and the materiality of film. So a representation of mourning and the exposure of a roll of film to light are blended into one in mourning. In addition, the title, Mourning, is not only a reference to what is being represented on screen, mourning, but also, in this case, since this was my first 60mm film, a hint, an awakening to the certain possibilities of film that I personally did not think of before beginning to work. In other words, while the work is complete in itself, I think, it also has a quality of unfinishedness in the sense that there is material that in a normal circumstance you would cut out and that has been not cut out, and also that to understand where it's coming from and that it is, that it may be also a metaphor for my awakening to certain possibilities of film, could only happen after you see the film, not during a viewing or before that. Another example is the first film that was shown at 5:30, Serene Velocity. Serene Velocity is all about action, not the action of cops and robbers chasing one another, but the action that makes film motion possible, which is, on the most basic level, the rapid shift from one frame to the next and what happens when there's a slight discrepancy of the image between two frames. This is basic to film as well as to other moving image mediums that depend upon the rapid intermittent projection of a series of still images to create optically a sense of motion. In Serene Velocity, as a film progresses, so does the discrepancy of the image between two frames, creating in that way a whole new pictorial world, playful with the image of the corridor, space on the two-dimensional plane, as well as the borders and the format of the screen rectangle itself. Throughout the piece, the space depicted on screen keeps changing. Walls, doorways, floors, ceiling, as well as the space of the corridor itself are being strangely animated and transformed. But representationally, the image of the corridor does not reveal anything that may be outside of the hallway. Then, near the end of the film, there's this mysterious light emanating beyond the door at the end of the corridor. In some ways, it's a reintroduction of a representational world, as well as affirming that this image of a corridor, or whatever else you want to call it, is being projected upon a screen. Yeah. So like a screen behind the projection. The light also implies a tremendous expansion of space representationally. The light also implies the rising of the sun and the beginning of day. In very general terms, what bleeds in representationally at that point for me into this work is time and the work outside the screen rectangle. So the space we have traversed so far in the movie, as it is shown, shows to be only a small fragment of a larger whole. The work could continue, in some ways you might say forever, beyond the corridor, into the world outside of it. The film doesn't have an ending, it just stops abruptly. Okay. Image ends, the film is over. The second film that was shown this afternoon, late afternoon, Shift, is a cinematic adventure of a different kind, though in some ways related. It is a meditation reflection not on the action between frames, but about composing a sense of a whole out of fragments, out of a series of related and sometimes unrelated shots. For example, in most films, the juxtaposition of a talking head looking to the left with an image of a talking head looking to the right may imply two characters looking and talking with each other. In Shift, such juxtapositions are a bit absurd, like an upside-down image of a driver looking out of his truck. Cut to an image of another truck right side up, then cut back to the upside-down shot responding to the action of the previous shot. Unlike in an earlier work of mine, Transparency, where cars play a dynamic role in Shift, cars seem to be confused and paralyzed. In Shift, cars offer a series of visual and audiovisual skits regarding the machine, the film strip, the pull of gravity, and space on a two-dimensional plane. Nothing is really resolved in any of these skits. They are fragments in themselves and part of a larger fragment, which is a work as a whole. One incident or skit does not lead to another, nor does the whole offer a fuller picture. Perhaps Shift is also an oblique observation of our contemporary urban landscape and the creatures that build, manipulate, and control those mechanical moving objects we call cars, trucks, buses, etc. Okay, I just need some water. Hold on.
Okay.
After the summer of 1968, or maybe it was 69, I don't recall, I became interested in making a film about two sisters that I knew then, Lisa and Suzanne. But I kept postponing the filming. Time passed, and then one day, Lisa informed me that she and her sister would be leaving New York in less than a week. It was a shock to me, especially since I was still not ready to film them. There were aspects to the work I still hadn't resolved. A few days before they left, we got together, and on that occasion, just to say goodbye, and on that occasion, I recorded some footage of them on the west side of Lower Manhattan. I had no plans to either use or edit this footage. It was just going to be some moving image snapshots of the two sisters at their on this parting occasion. And beyond that, perhaps a reminder to myself of a film that never got made. It's the first time I've seen it from the projection booth this evening since 1969. Kind of strange looking at it. A few months after I had recorded the footage, I had the footage developed and looked at the two unedited camera rolls. I then spliced them together and decided to insert some black leader between some of the shots to emphasize their random and open-ended character. That's where I left it. I liked it that way. Could I have done something else with it? Perhaps, but I never tried. Unmade film. Okay. I was going to read something that we are not going to see tonight, and I'll get to that later, okay? All right. Why don't we look at her work, okay? So we're going to look now at Coney Island Boardwalk. It's a 25-minute digital sound piece. It was recorded in 2010 and edited in 2013. I couldn't have planned it better. Perfect. You know, for this occasion, then, this is a special presentation for you.
I was told that it worked fine in the other room, and I'm sorry.
No, but it's interesting. You know,
okay,
it
good.
Leaves it open
yeah,
and makes you wonder. The sound is also, you know, two-thirds of it totally garble, you know, that.
I wanted to ask you about that, but.
Oh, it's garble.
Okay.
Absolutely, yeah. but, you know, I could have stopped it, but I felt, no, this is perfect for the occasion.
Okay.
Okay, so you have like a live experience of something that's unfinished in terms of an experience of what I might have intended at one time. That's terrific. Thank you. I'm glad things didn't work out. but I'll read you my notes, brief notes on the work. If I have it, yeah, I do have it somewhere. Here. Okay. All right. How did I get to make this piece? In October 2010. I came across an article in a local newspaper about Coney Island. According to the article, the leases for the old concession stands along the boardwalk were not going to be renewed. There were plans to tear down the old concession stands and replace them with new ones, lease them to more upscale businesses, add some more attractions, perhaps build a new hotel nearby, and replace the old wooden boardwalk with concrete, with a concrete walkway, all in the hope of turning Coney Island into a gentrified tourist attraction. After reading the article, my wife and I decided to visit Coney Island. We much enjoyed the character and atmosphere of the boardwalk and went back a few weeks later for a second visit. It was a third visit around Thanksgiving time. On these three occasions, I took my camera with me and recorded some images. It was not so much an attempt to document or make a film about the place, as much as record a few moving image snapshots of what we encountered on those visits. Over the winter, I then edited the footage. First edit was a fairly straightforward assembly, one image at a time, with no attempt to be playful with the material. I enjoyed looking at the edited footage, but I did not think of it as something I would want to show publicly. A couple years later, in 2013, I looked at the footage again and changed it into what it is now. I liked the transformation of the material. However, even after viewing it more than a dozen times, over a period of perhaps 2 or 3 months, I still couldn't decide what to make of it. So it went back on the shelf and then more or less forgotten until Lynn asked me to show unfinished or abandoned work. Okay. All right. This morning, in the process of cleaning and getting ready the 60 millimeter prints for today's presentation, I discovered that the color print of Untitled Part 1, 1981, which I had not shown in some 20 years, had faded into a monochromatic red. In that process, the images had also lost much of their contrast and saturation. In that condition, I could not get myself to presenting it here this evening. I much apologize for that. As I could not think of another unfinished work that I had ready to show here tonight, I decided to substitute Untitled with the following digital pieces. Total running time is approximately, let's see, 23 minutes, two works. Good Grief will be the first one, 2014. 4 minutes silent, so we don't have a problem with sound with the first one. The second one is a bit longer, 19 minutes sound, A Commuter's Life, What a Life. That's the title of the second piece. Actually, I did bring a third piece, but when we tried to play it before 5:30, all we were getting is the sound, not the image. And I decided, okay, that's it, not that one tonight. So I hope it goes well. If there is a problem with the projection, I really apologize. But we will have to stop, and then we'll just have a Q&A. We can go on as long as you want to, talking about any of the work or anything else you want to bring up, as long as it's not politics. Okay, so we will start with Good Grief. Okay. Okay. There any questions or comments? I'll do the best I can to respond to your.
For your sound projects, do you use any special equipment to capture the sound, or do you have anything in particular that you're trying to capture?
Are you talking about the last piece?
That and the Coney Island one.
Coney Island. Both of them are. Just whatever sounds were recorded on the camera, you know, the mics on those two pieces, for those two pieces are ridiculous in a way, high fidelity. I mean, they're hardly, it was recorded, they were, the second one, the last one, working with a small Panasonic, I think it's called 100 something, DCM 100 or something like that. Like a still camera, and the micro. It's for still pictures. Really great for still pictures, and it's fine for moving images. But sound, forget it. If there's a sound that's further than 10 feet away, you don't record it. You know, unless it's really a squeaky, high pitched sound. You know. So I live with that. I can use it or discard it. You know, I like that rumbling sound sometimes. If I want something specific, then I'll take a tape recorder and record sound and use it. You know, but most of the time I either accept or it really depends. I'm free to use the sound recorded, discard that sound, put something else on it, or not use any sound, you know, just work with the image. There are only two sounds that are superimposed in the last piece. Near the beginning, there's this sound, it sounds like somebody either opening or closing the zipper on a what's it called, a business briefcase, and you hear it near the end again. You know, it's like commuter opens and then he's busy working, he or she, and then I'm arriving at my terminal. You know, so it's time for me to just pack up. But those are the only two sounds tampered in. Otherwise, it's what was recorded.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How did you come across the footage that you used to make Good Grief, which I believe is the only film you showed tonight that uses found footage? And what were your intentions when you came across that footage?
Intentions. I'm interested in the history of the moving image, which includes film, but also goes back to who knows how the moving image What are some of the beginnings? You know, shadow plays, possibly some of the earliest form of moving images. So they're really haunted by that. I'm interested because I feel that much of the work I do has to do with trying to preserve, record, and share in time and beyond my own time about things that I care about in one way or another. And I've been interested in the history of the moving image for a long time, you know, very, very much. I would say it really goes back to a work that hasn't been shown here. Well, the second film I made, 16 millimeter, it's called Wait. And it looks very much, there's just two people sitting at a table, so to speak, more or less. And it looks very much in a very simplified way, like the kind of movies that were made in the 1890s or turn of the century. You know? Then there's a film that I made in 1968, released in 69, called Reverberation. And that's also my own footage recorded in the lower Manhattan area when the destruction of all this area that later became the World Trade Center took place. And I was moved by the destruction of the history of at least 100 years, if not more, not only of architecture, but of human history that took place there, you know, and the kind of New York that existed at that time. The film that I wanted to do with Lisa and Suzanne was recorded in that area after the destruction. It was part of the problem. I had made this other film called Reverberation, and then I wanted to do this film with Lisa and Suzanne, but I waited. I couldn't figure out what it is that I wanted to do. It wasn't just going to be a straight recording. You know, I wanted to change because it had something to do. And in the process of waiting, what took place is they finished tearing down most of the buildings, you know. So I wouldn't have been able to make the film, but I still wanted to make this film with Lisa and Suzanne. They were good friends, that's all, man. I'll get to you in a minute. Okay, let me just respond. I'm giving you a long answer. Okay, where it comes from, I'm trying to give you possibly a broader response, but I'm trying to enter to this particular work. I make works that are often classified as avant-garde, and that means, the term avant-garde, where does it come from? Are we talking about 1840s France with, the new, you know, like towards the last quarter of the 19th century, that's where avant-garde comes from, the French avant-garde that took place at that point in time. And it had to do a lot with the destruction of what preceded it. And it was funny, I'm interested in moving forward at the same time with this deep longing to have some sense of what took place before my own time. Partially because my life just moves forward. You know, it's linear, and you know, now I'm 75. You know, I may have a week left, a day left, maybe 100 years or more. You know, I don't know. But I see all these changes, and moved, and I want to frame things and hopefully share them with other people somehow. 1974, I was invited to a film festival, film exhibition, not festival, but an exhibition in Switzerland. And they gave me, the festival gave me exhibition, sorry. Annette Michelson was actually the curator for this program. And I received a 21-day ticket to go to Europe. In those days, 1974, was the cheapest ticket you can get. If you bought one that was 7 days or less, you paid the most. Then it was 14 days, cheaper. 21 days, the cheapest. And after that, I have no idea. So anyway, I landed in Geneva and then went to Paris. And I fell in love with the city. What I loved about the city was all these, I was in the present, you know, very much aware. There were cars, people, living creatures, but all around me, including the cobblestones, they were ancient from another time. And I was so moved by that. Then I went to Amsterdam, another ancient, you know, a city with a lot of history. And as I've been looking at paintings, I could also see works just walking through the streets, especially Rembrandt. I mean, I just couldn't believe, I would stare at people, you know, I would see his paintings, where he was coming from in these contemporary faces. From there I went to Montreux, where Annette was had set up this exhibition of, what was it called? At the moment I can't remember, something like New Structures in
New
Film or something
film.
Like that.
New Forms in Film.
New Forms in Film, thank you. And I think during my stay in Montreux one day, Annette says, "Here, Ernie, you would like to see this film." And it was the first, what's it called? Phantom Ride film I saw. You know, long tracking shot going down Market Street, San Francisco, before the earthquake.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. You know, I'd never seen an early film so long. I didn't want it to go to the end. I knew it was going to the Embarcadero. But I didn't want, I wanted to turn, go this way, that way, you know, wait until you get there, okay. It just kept going. And as I was looking at it, my own recollection of first arriving in San Francisco after being released from the army in 1966. I'd been drafted into the army. You know. I'd gotten off the bus, arrived in San Francisco, something 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, it was still dark. And at some point, I was going to look for a hotel room, but it was still early. So at some point I was tired sitting at the bus at Greyhound station, and I walked about half a block to what was, I hadn't been there before, Market Street. As I reached Market Street, I heard these streetcar bells, and that took me back to childhood, riding trolleys in Milwaukee. Very funny thing, you know, very funny thing, trolleys. I hadn't seen or heard one in a long time, 20 years or so, okay, at that point. And then I watched this ghost move down to the end of the Embarcadero, you know, going down Market Street. So this recollection came back as I was looking at Market Street, you know, the strip down Market Street.
Right.
And I very much wanted to look at the work, you know. So I asked Annette, where did she get this print? And she mentioned a mutual friend, somebody I knew too, you know, Ruth Perlmother, who was teaching and living. I don't know if she's still, anybody here knows her. She used to teach at Temple in Philadelphia. So as soon as I got off the plane and got home, I called her up and I said, can I have a print? She said, sure. So within a couple weeks, I got a print and I looked at the film. Now, my experience of Europe was very much reverberating in me, very, very much. And it brought up for the first time also my history, my parents' history. You know, they were born in Germany. And in a different lifetime, I would have possibly grown up in Berlin. So anyway, eventually I decided these two experiences, the film itself, my experience of remembering San Francisco in 1966, and the moving experience of Europe collided and focused upon Market Street. And out of that, I made a film called Eureka. And let's see, after that, I began to look more and more for early works. I was really interested in just seeing things. And in recent times, this film that we looked at today came across to me through a friend. It's about a minute long. And I just couldn't believe it. I felt there were so many ironic things happening. So I began to play with it. And that's how Good Grief came into being. And so I have some early work. I mean, original early works from the early years of cinema are not necessarily that I tampered with. You know, so.
Thank you. That was a lovely answer.
Sure. Sorry to give you this long thing, but I felt, since you were asking, I think it's important to understand where something is coming from. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've seen, since you made Eureka, which is one of my favorite pieces, a more pristine copy of that original 1906 film has been found, 35mm.
Yes.
Have you seen the new?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
It was shown a year or two ago. At MoMA, you know, it was a screening. I thought it was wonderful. And actually, I was so happy to see it. My first impression was maybe, you know, it's time to retire my film.
My thought was you would remake the film using this great footage.
No. That's exactly, see, when I looked at the film that was preserved recently on 35, you know, it was as close as possible to the original film, not necessarily how it may have been projected, but, you know, and it was very good, terrific. And then I realized, and looking and thinking about my own work, that I really, although I tried as much as possible to let the original breathe on its own without my interfering with it, that I really changed the film. And that this is no longer a phantom film. It is a phantom film, yes, in the sense that all movies are phantom films. I mean, it's over, you know. As soon as you record something, it's gone. The moment is not there anymore. We're not in the present when we're looking at something. We're looking at something that took place a while back. But one of the easy things to pick up, for example, is that unlike in down Market Street or whatever title the original is given at this point in time, in Eureka, the movement is never smooth. There is, if you really pay attention to it, there is no sense of moving through space. It's like stop, then it moves forward like in Serene Velocity, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It just jerks forward, and then it stops, and then it jerks forward. It's like space, flatness, and the people, so-called people, they're silhouettes, just like the silhouettes in Vampire, if you wish. And they move like mummies, you know, like there, it's not life-like motion. You know, it's like the border between life and death in cinema, which has to do with still motion or sense of motion, you know, it's real as experience. And I'm interested in that moment in that film, you know. So, and the contrast, the little that I tried to do to increase the contrast just changes. The sides of the street, of Market Street, in the restored version, I could finally see what on earth was going on, all these stores and people walking around. In my film, it's blobs of black and white, you know, these round little things bopping around, and it's like a reference to grain, film
yes.
grain, you know, and having a life, a funny life we associate with human creatures, but it's something else. And also in the original, the camera turns around. In mine, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
You can't turn around.
So Ernie, I wanted to ask you about your return to New York City. You were gone from New York for 18 years, and then you came back. And it seems like you've seen New York in new ways. For example, I'm not sure you were as interested in the water as you were when you lived here before, or the horizon line. And there's something really exhilarating in this new body of work that you've produced in your return. And I wanted to know what you saw in New York in differently, or if it's not different, but you're different, or something.
My apologies for drinking in front of you and not sharing it with you. But it's only one cup. Let's see, where to start on that one? I was away for 18 and a half years. I never really wanted to leave New York. When I first arrived in New York, I felt this is where I want to live. This is home. It, you know, the pluses and minuses to New York. It's always had those problems, you know, that we see here. But at the same time, I felt more comfortable here than I felt anywhere else that I've ever been to, whether in the U.S. or in Europe. So, it's home. But I have to make a living. I have to pay rent, buy food, etc. In 1988, I was offered a teaching position, a part-time teaching position in San Francisco. Before that, I was teaching at Bard College. But I was a visitor, one course a year. How do you make a living on one course a year? And I knew my visiting position was going to terminate. I had a new contract, but that meant just one more year, one course a year. And then what do I do after that? And at the time, it was hard for me to find work, except in places where I didn't want to go to. You know, those possible. Now, I don't want to put any city down. It's just there were places I knew I wouldn't want to move to. And then this invitation came, and I like San Francisco. It's a beautiful place, especially from what I remember going to before. It's changed. Now it's, I haven't been there in a long time, but my understanding is it's more, whatever, okay. So we moved to San Francisco, and basically thinking, that's it, you know, that's going to be home for, from now on. But I think from the very beginning, I missed New York. I kept looking for something that I couldn't find in San Francisco. I liked the city, I liked the climate, I had no problems with it, but there was something that I was, like the center, a gravity, a point of gravity that was missing. And every time I came back to New York, I felt homesick. I felt, this is where I really want to be. And I would go back, and it was nice and pleasant, but I'd missed New York. So in the back of my mind, I really had never left New York. I was just living and making a living in San Francisco. So in 2006, I was reaching my retirement age, which was also at the time when our son Daniel was graduating from eighth grade. And in San Francisco, or you know, to go to high school, you have to go to a different school than you go for primary schools. So it was the right time to move. So we came back to New York. Now, you know, you feel your age at that point. I came back, and it was a changed city. And I felt the rhythm of the city was different. Not necessarily that it changed. Yes, it has changed, but it was intense. And I was then over 66 or whatever. And you know, you slow down no matter how much you try not to. So, and I began to really, for the first time, explore areas of the city as I hadn't before. So, let's see, maybe I'm moving beyond what you're asking. So I, at this point, I would say since coming back, there's been much more work focused on Brooklyn, which is where I live. And there are pieces in New York that I've done too that I haven't shown. You know, there is a almost an hour-long piece on the Lower East Side and the changes that have taken place. I'm uncomfortable releasing it for some reason. Not that I don't like it. It's different from Coney Island material. It's just, well, let's put it this way. These little cameras, digital cameras, they allow you to break through privacies, you know, in a way that a big 16-millimeter camera does not. And in recording material, sometimes you go beyond what you should be recording. And I don't know. I don't want to be sued. Let's put it that way. Things can get out. So I might end up showing it elsewhere, but far away from New York City. Or maybe it's for a work from 20, 30 years from now, you know, so for history. Yeah.
And why do you call the last film that we saw today unfinished? It seems absolutely
perfect. Oh, no, I didn't. I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. I was planning to show Untitled Part 9, which is an unfinished work. And just like, I know you haven't seen it, okay? It was recorded in Brighton Beach in 1981. at a time when there was a dribble of Russians and East Europeans that were able to leave the Soviet Union then, and most of them, many of them, ended up living in Brighton Beach, you know, came to the U.S. Some of them possibly moved elsewhere. And they were mostly retired people, you know, older and middle-aged or retired. And I was attracted to that area for that reason. And I kept taking the train to just walk and watch human traffic, you know, these people having a hard time adjusting to where they were. It's a different culture, you know, it's an open culture, and they came from really a different way of life. And I was also thinking of my aging parents at that point in time. And so I thought of making a work in two parts. The first part was meant to be almost very obliquely stated. It was focused on close-ups of people in their activities on the street. It was all filmed from a, what is it called? The platform, the elevated train platform.
Highline?
No, not Highline. Some of the shops, the residential areas, and it was going to be also a sound piece. So a balancing of these two things. One is like a journey across the ocean and then their new home, so to speak. But I had between 81, when Untitled Part 1 was finished, and 84, the end of the summer of 84, I was hardly in New York. I was in Berlin for almost 10 months. And then I was teaching in Chicago, you know. So, and by the time I came back, I tried to pick up on that part two and began to work there. But the tension that I needed, the focus on what I wanted to do was no longer there. So I felt you can't make it. You know, it'd be a mannered work, an idea, and not felt out any longer. So I, you know, so that's why I was going to show part one and talk about it in relationship to what I was going to do in part two. But, and I apologize again, but the print is not there, you know, to be seen. So, yes, go ahead.
Maybe related to what you're talking about, I was wondering if you think you have a different approach or outlook when you're filming people as opposed to places or objects.
Yes, of course. I mean, I tend to see film largely as, you know, it's if you think of a painting, you know, for example, there's a canvas and paint. Yes, you can represent figures, but it's paint, material, and, you know, a surface, paper or canvas or whatever. And I can do that more easily when I don't have the human figure in front of me to deal with. As soon as you film, we're human beings, human creatures, and we relate, no matter how much we want to avoid that, to the human face, human body. So certain kinds of abstractions, I can't get myself to do it. I've tried it many times, and I would just reject that possibility. I just feel, nope. You know, it's just like manipulating. There's something about it, because the manipulation that you're doing in some ways expresses who you are and what you're doing. And I can do that with more neutral images, but I can't do it myself. There are other people who can do it. I can't. I just can't get myself to doing that. So that's one reason a lot of work I do doesn't have so-called human, but it is involved with human experience. The last work that we've looked at, you know, to me, it's on the one hand, it's like a formal thing, you know, like beautiful design in some ways, but it comes out of not only a lifetime of travel in a way, but in 2012, I was teaching at Harvard and commuting back and forth every week. And from that commute, the title sounds like I'm making fun of all these commuters, but it was my commuting back and forth. And in some ways, it's a summary for me of this travel. Not the very beginning, it may seem different, but if you wait for a while, if you are into the image and what is taking place, after a while, you see it's like a poetic summary. It's almost like you close your eyes, you hear the sound, and as you're traveling, it's all these different journeys that you've taken, you know, traveling from place to place or back and forth or whatever. That's what it is for me.
Yeah. It kept you more than 4 hours, so I'm gonna say,
well,
if people have other questions, I can come down and talk to you. But
sure.
If you
thank you.
Thank you.
Very patient. Thank you.